OK, bonjour tout le monde. Welcome back. There is a handout for this session. If everybody has got one who's here. We could maybe, could you leave them with Pablo at the door? I want one. Merci. And yeah. So we have one talk now, and then our coffee break, and then the last longer session with a couple of talks and our round table. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Professor Roberto Cassati, who is director of the Institut Jean Nicot. Apart from many other lines of work, Roberto has worked on place for many years now, including the classic book Parts and Places from the last millennium, I think that was it. Yeah. 99. And recently, Roberto has been working on place in other contexts in the disorientation project at Jean Nicot. Among recent publications is a collection of essays that he's edited on philosophy and sailing, and a solo authored book on the philosophy of the ocean, which as yet is looking for an English publisher, for an English translation. And coming out later this year, I think, is the new book on the cognitive life of maps with MIT Press, which is the material that Roberto is going to talk about a bit today when he is ready to speak to us. Thanks very much on the cognitive life of maps, Roberto.
Thank you very much for the for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about maps. So I don't have slides. I have a few images that you just as a warm up. This is an image which is has been marketed as a correction to the Mercator distortion. So gives you an idea of the real size of Russia, which is it's difficult to do this type of maps. It's a map which tries to put sizes at scale, and also the incredible oversized representation of Greenland, which comes out typically in Mercator, which is the projection used in Google Maps, as big as the whole South American continent, where it is more or less as big as Argentina. This is a different map, slightly more difficult to parse. Maybe I have it better version here. The Spielhaus projection, which tries to have the ocean in the middle and the land out surrounding it. So the ocean is kind of a big pond in this map. You can recognize some features, maybe others are not as easily recognizable. And it's a map which is used to underline the unity of the ocean as a whole system. And another map, which is also sea-related, is this map by Siegel and Cohen, the territorial map of the sea. Let's see if I can enlarge it a little bit. So this is what happens when you take the extension of the 200 nautical miles, constituting the exclusive economic zones. You take them as being a territory on the same footing as land territories. So the idea of this map is that you erase the coastline whenever there is a state which has an exclusive economic zone. And something interesting happens here. I can point it from this, but you can see. So the Mediterranean disappears completely. There are, France is an oceanic state with a small continental appendix, being 20 times larger at sea than it is on land. And there are many strange issues, strange things, completely round things, which are small islands with a 200-mile radius around. So there is one single thing here, which is called Clipperton. This is my favorite geographic object. Clipperton is a 11 square kilometers atoll, which has been disputed between France and Mexico for a long time, until the King of Italy adjudicated it to France on a whim. And the area of the exclusive economic zone of Clipperton is 80% of the area of continental France. So, and apparently it's very important because it's on the Clipperton zone, which is rich in polymetallic nodules, which are important for the batteries of your scooters in Paris. So a lot of strategic issues. It's not what I'm going to talk about, but maps, of course, have a lot. I mean, a lot of investment on maps, a lot of conversations start with maps, a lot of conversations end with maps, geopolitical conversations in particular. And this conversation is some kind of articulation between this artifact and the way we talk about it and the way we use it for making decisions and changing the shape of the world. So the cognitive life of maps is ambiguous. I don't think that maps have a life of their own. They do not do anything basically by their own, just printed things of reason. We don't have a mind, and they're not thinking. So if you think of extended mind, you have to think of maps in a way in which you do not give them some kind of psychology. It's not the life of cognitive maps. I'm not going to talk about cognitive maps at all. Cognitive maps are theoretical constructs which are used to via an inference to the best explanation to explain how we are able to find shortcuts or detours in areas which we have not explored yet. So it's typically the best posit is the access to some kind of internal representation which is map-like. But still, there is a sense of idea that there is a cognitive life of maps, which is the way in which we interact with maps. So when we find our way around, I think there are at least or maybe at most four different ways to do it. One is to let your brain do it for you. So each of you can find their way out of this building, I guess, without having to ask directions, having to consult a map, having to use a GPS. You can just go and because your brain did the mapping for you. So this is what we could call a system one type of finding your way. It's automatic, it's stimulus driven, and you do not use any big processing facilities from attention and from memory, working memory. When you tax attention and working memory is when you are looking for directions for more, trying to get to more to places which are a bit more complicated to get at, such as, I don't know, Gare de Lyon from here. If you're not Parisian, you might be able to find your way, but you think about it. And thinking about it means taxing working memory and attention. So this would be kind of a system two of orientation. But then in those two cases, you don't need to use any artifact. So we can move to the system four is when you delegate completely to a GPS assistant navigator. So you just type in Gare de Lyon, and then it talks to you and say, okay, 5 steps to the door, 7 steps downstairs, and so on and so forth. And you don't have to look at a map, nothing. You just listen to those directions. You're not doing any navigational computation, basically. All the navigational computations are delegated to the instrument in that case. And maps are what I would call a system three here, somehow an intermediate kind. So when you use a map, well, it's necessary for you to use it, is the way you find your way around, if you don't have any other means, of course. But then you have to do the navigational computations yourself by using the map. So there is a kind of interaction between you and the map, and this is what I'm interested in, basically. But not from a psychological point of view. I'm trying to understand what is the complexity of maps so that you can run navigational computation on them. So it's mostly a syntactical, semantic study of maps. Of course, when you do this study of maps, you have contrast classes that you want to understand or put against maps for understanding what maps are. So diagrams, written language, or pictures. And if we have time, I show in which sense we can say that pictures are maps. And you also want to steer clear of discussions about mappings. Of course, maps are mappings, but not all mappings are maps. I will give you a simple example. Consider a book. Books have typically indexes and tables of content. So tables of contents constitute some kind of a map of a book, because some of the spatial relations between items in the table of content reflect the spatial structures of the chapters in the book. An index is a mapping onto the book contents, but it is not organized as a map. There are other types of organization, alphabetic order or whatever. So there is a clear mapping in that case, but which is not a map. So I want you to just keep in mind this distinction between mappings and maps. And now, before going on, I would like to introduce what I think is going to be my most valuable contribution to philosophy, which is the distinction between objections and distractions. So in the discussion about maps, you encounter a huge number of counterexamples or tricky topics, and you have to make a clear distinction between things which are objections to accounts of maps and distractions. So one distraction, for instance, is the fact that all maps lie, supposedly, and as it's proven by the case of Greenland that we saw before. So in projection, in Mercator projection, you will see that Greenland is much larger than it is in reality. So there is there are a lot of discussions about the ways in which map lies, map create power structures, and I think I agree with most of them, but they tend to distract from the main point, which is how do maps do that? So what is specific of maps? So many other things are reflections of power issues or lie or create distortions, even descriptions. So here is another example of a distraction. You can see this map in the middle. Is it a map of Italy or not, according to you? What is your first intuition? Who thinks this is a map of Italy? Who thinks this is not a map of Italy? Agnostics? Okay. Who has changed their mind and now thinks it is a map of Italy, just in case? Okay. Well, why do you think it is not a map of Italy? Who? You raised your hand. Because it is east, and so why a map which is east-west reversed is not a map of Italy, which is east-west reversed is not a map of Italy? Yeah, so it depends on the use. So everything here is very much controlled by pragmatics. So and the point is, I can always find a kind of pragmatic which helps you to find those cases, to put those cases in the category of distractions. So imagine sitting in the center of the Earth and now looking out at Italy, projecting. This would be a map of Italy in that case. You can use it for projecting it into stars, which is done in some cases in courses in geography. So I just want to prevent many distractions in the discussion. So and to get at a theory of map, I want to introduce a methodological constraint. So reducing the case of things that I would like to consider as maps in order to enlarge the area under discussion. So the first methodological constraint is the same dimensionality. And it could be debated, but stay with me. So the same dimensionality is that you might have a 1D map of a 1D territory. You can have a 2D map of a 2D territory, a 3D map of a 3D territory. But maps typically, or paradigmatically, represent things that have the same dimensionality. So many distractions, many objections, maybe a map of the Earth is actually a 2D map of a 3D territory. We can discuss about that. But let's focus on this methodological restriction. So only consider same dimensional maps. Accept a distinction between a map and a territory. This is, could be contested. People would say that there is no territory unless there is a map. I think there is a difference between a map and territory. And a territory is what a map maps. So this is a territory, for instance, and you can have a map of this territory by putting the place of people in this room, and so on and so forth. I'm totally open as to what a territory is. A territory is something that could be mapped anyway. A third constraint is a mereotopological constraint, so big names, but there has to be some structure preservation from map to territory and vice versa. That is, if you have in a map an area which is contained in another area, completely contained in another area, then the areas, the parts of the territory which are represented by those two areas have to display the same relations. So if A is part of B in a map, then the area which is represented by A has to be part of the area which is represented by B. If A is contiguous with B on a map, then the area which is represented by A has to be contiguous with the area which is represented by B. Then there may be other constraints that you can put, metric constraints, projective constraints, I don't care. The important thing is that for something to be considered as a map, it has to satisfy the mereotopological constraint. Nothing short of that can make you have maps of territories. Based on that, with Achille Varzi, which is the co-author of the book that you mentioned, the 99 book, we developed a skeletal semantics for maps because there is a target here which was not there yet, which is Fodor's picture principle, according to which every part of a picture of A is a picture of a part of A. And this seems to block any type of compositionality for maps. So we were looking into a compositional deconstruction or decomposition of maps that could allow us to create a semantics for which certain molecular maps have a truth value or a semantic value which depends on the semantic value of their components. And the intuition is very simple, actually. You should imagine maps as, first of all, a just colored surfaces with no names, no lines, just patches of color corresponding to properties. And the idea is that you have a certain color on a certain area of a map, then what you're saying is that a certain territory which corresponds to that area on the map has the property that corresponds to that color. So for instance, if light green means is a part of a territory of the United States, then if this area is light green, that means that the corresponding area of a map is a part of the territory of the United States. There are limits to what you can express with this. I mean, what you do in sentential or propositional logic, you cannot express all the subtleties of language. So you're translating into propositional logic some sentences because you want to make it appear the certain inferential structures as a function of the type of constituents that you are able to elicit and the compositional rules. This is what you're doing. We are doing here. So we are trying to get a very simple structure, and we are trying to show in which sense you can have a composition. So the composition now is as follows. You should imagine maps as superposition of transparencies printed one color at a time. So imagine you go to a printer shop and you say, okay, I would like to have a map like this. And he will say, okay, I'm going to print it one color at a time. And you can have different transparencies. And each of those transparencies is then evaluated semantically. How? It's very simple. Truth conditions is that if the area corresponding to a certain color area on the map has the property which corresponds to that color, and the area, which is the complement of the force, doesn't have a property that corresponds to the color, then that transparent layer is true. So it's a kind of strange truth condition in the sense that it takes into account both the area and its complement. If the area corresponding to region A on the map has a certain property and the complement of that area, the reference of the complement of that area doesn't have that property, then that layer is true. So you can have a true value for any of those layers, and then, starting from that, the truth of a map is just a function of the truth of the different layers by, I would say, conjunction, say the same truth table, basically. Which means that, if you want to be slightly more formal, these type of formal maps, and I want to remind you that these are just maps with colors spread on a surface, no names, no lines, no symbols, no icons, just colors. Once you're able to translate into that simple syntactic structure, they have a power which is close to the power of the positive, non-quantified fragment of propositional, of predicate logic, in which you have very small clauses such as P of A and Q of B and Q of A. And you're able to say things about individuals in the world, which are world regions, by predicating somehow, there are objections to that, not distractions, but real objections, predicating a certain property, which is the property expressed by that color. You cannot express much with that, but you can still express something. It gives you an idea of how map truth can be retrieved from the truth of components, because you found the components and you found the compositional rule. Now, I said, well, you're talking about individuals. Individuals are regions of space. So you have something that refers to those individuals, and these are the regions of the map. And it's an analogy, but it works pretty well. Those regions on the map behave like singular terms. So items which have a unique reference behave like singular terms, but they are singular terms of a very specific and strange kind, because they are structured singular terms. They are regions, and regions are made of regions, which in turn are singular terms. And so the myriad topological constraint is activated here, because then you have singular terms which have a myriad topological structure. There is a simple example in the handout when you can look at a comparison with natural language. So we do have spatially structured singular terms in language, but they're not the general case. So the county of York is a structured singular term. The county of York refers to the county of York. And York refers to York. And York is part of the county of York. And York, the term, is part of a singular term, the county of York. So there is a mapping between the structure of a singular term, the county of York, and York, to the structure of the county of York and York. But this is not the general case. Singular terms in natural language do not behave like that. So you have the capital of France is, again, a structured singular term. The capital of France is Paris, but it is contained in France. Although the capital of France contains France in the term defined. So we have, I would say, the conceptual resources to understand the existence of structured singular terms, but they are not the general case in natural language. They are the norm in maps. So the next point is natural generativity, which is a property of some iconic representations, among which probably maps, but we'll see. It was defined by Flynn Shear in a wonderful book of the 80s, Deeper into Pictures. In natural language, you have you don't have natural generativity. You have it for pictures. So this is a case for natural language. In natural language, the knowledge of the meaning of a sentence like "my cat attacked your dog," and perceptual acquaintance with other things such as dolls, smileys, and cars does not generate knowledge of the meaning of "my doll smiled to your car." So you might understand what my cat attacked your dog, and then you have some kind of perceptual acquaintance with other items. But this perceptual acquaintance plus the knowledge of the meaning of that sentence does not give you access to the meaning of other sentences. It's very clear if you try it in a foreign language, for instance. Knowledge of the meaning of a picture representing a cat attacking your dog and perceptual acquaintance with dolls, smiles, and cars generates some knowledge of the meaning of a picture of my doll smiling to your car. This is the idea of natural generativity for Shear. So once you understand how a picture works, and you have perceptual acquaintance with some of the things that you can represent in pictures, then all pictures are transparent for you. You can understand all pictures. Many distractions, some objections, but the main idea is a contrast here with natural language. Natural language does not naturally generate. You have to know the meaning of all the terms in the language that you use. It's not enough that you have perceptual acquaintance with the items which are represented. So, turning your page, maps hypergenerate. Not even perceptual acquaintance is needed, just some kind of spatial competence. The generativity of maps is here specific. So this is a simple example. So imagine that I'm giving you this situation in which you have, this is my small dog, and this is my big elephant on purpose. This is my small dog, and this is my big elephant, and this is what happens. So I'm describing a situation here that you would interpret as the elephant is approaching the dog pretty naturally. So this approaching interpretation is based on your understanding of the spatial behavior of objects on a surface. This is a model of a situation. This is mapping some kind of situation, and it is just the footprint of those items on the table, which is necessary for you to understand what goes on here when I do this, after having told you that this is a representation of my small dog and this is a representation of my big elephant. Perfect. So this is what I consider a kind of hypergeneration. You don't have to have any acquaintance with elephants or dogs, just some kind of spatial competence related to the relationship between two objects on a plane, for you to be able to understand what a map is and how a map works. So the mappy component of this representation is totally transparent to you once you understand what spatial distribution and a spatial footprint is. So it's what Chris Peacock would call a nexus. There is a set of things that hang together here. Maps, on one hand, are highly abstractable to the point of easily reducing to formal maps. So I can really create very easily a formal map of the situation by taking away the glass, taking away the bottle, just having two patches of color on the floor here on the table, and have them move relative to each other. Then another thing that you know about maps, and this is something related to their cognitive life, is a kind of a magic that maps have. It is related to this point. I call it here the automaticity of the assignment. Suppose I draw a square, or maybe a rectangular, say, and I tell you, okay, this is a map of this place. As soon as you draw the rectangular, the space inside it, and I give this assignment, this large rectangular is a map of this place. All the different parts inside the rectangular become immediately semantically active. None of them is excluded from a semantic game. All of them are activated. And I mean, it's kind of magic in the sense why you can have maps on the cheap, but you do. And basically, the work of a cartographer is then to find, is an epistemological work, it's not a metaphysical work, is to find out which parts of that rectangular correspond to which part of the room here, and what's in them. But those parts already refer to those parts of the room. So the reference is already there. There is a sentence in the Tractatus by Wittgenstein said that once you, most things in a symbolism are arbitrary, but what is not arbitrary is that once you have certain assignments in the symbolism, some things is going to follow automatically. This is what happens. The paradigm case for this is maps. So you have those rectangulars, those shapes, any shape, and then you decide this is a map of the world, is a map of the hotel particulier here. All the parts of it are already semantically active. And knowing this is also to understand automatically the natural generativity of map. It's basically the same thing seen from different sides. And then I won't say much about maps and pictures, but maybe I will say something. So maps, to conclude this overview of what I think is a theory of maps. So maps are distinct from diagrams and other types of analog representations. You can see that you can have diagrams of spatial regions of geographic entities, say a diagram of the size, the relative size of Finland and Switzerland. So you will have two bars, size of Finland, size of Switzerland. This is an analog representation of a geographic situation because you get some information about the fact that Finland is larger than Switzerland. But this is not a map. Mere topological constraint is not satisfied. You cannot do anything with the different relations between parts of Switzerland and parts of Finland. This is an analog representation of a geographic entity, and not all analog representations of geographic entities are maps. And the next point is that you have the same dimensionality constraint, the mere topological constraint, this type of nested semantic, the automaticity of the assignment, the natural generativity, and another feature of maps is red dotability. The fact that you can put red dots on maps signaling your position in it, and signaling at the same time the position of a map in the environment. So there is a long discussion here, which is inherited by discussions on indexicality and on C2A recognition. But basically, you have to think of the so-called "you are here" map. You have some in Paris, so you have a map, and then you are a red dot on it, telling you you're here. In order for the map to work, that is for you to use it as a way to find your way in the environment, the map has to bear, of course, a representational relationship to the environment. It has to represent the environment you want to navigate in. But it also has to bear no representational relations to the environment. And one is situation, basically it's being there, just being where it is. And in order for that situation to be epistemically useful, it looks as if the map has to have some kind of real tie to the environment. So sometimes it's just nailed to the place. You cannot move it. If you could move it, it wouldn't work. You cannot take a map of Paris and to Naples with a "you are here." "You are here" doesn't work anymore. There is a lot to be said about red dotting and maybe blue dotting, which is what you have today on GPS assisted navigators. The no representational relation between the map and the environment using the GPS is given by the fact that the blue dot on the GPS stays with you all the time. It's the map which is moving under there. So what I'm trying to demonstrate in the book is that this relation that is being there, or some kind of causal relation, is a bit too strong for maps to be able to be used for navigational purposes. What you need is something weaker, which is epistemic segregation, that is the fact that the map is only visible from a limited set of positions relative to the environment you want to navigate. The example here would be, and I finish on that, would be the example of suppose you had somebody wants to tell me where I am to help me because I don't have my GPS on me anymore, I don't have any maps anymore. But they can track my position somehow on, because I have a tracker on myself. So they have a map at their home. My wife, say, not that my wife controls my movement, but it's a transaction between consentant adults. So if it happens, but it doesn't happen in our case. But suppose she does it, she may want to call me and tell me where I am. So it would, she invented a very powerful projector, and she projects my blue dot position on her map, so I am in Paris, on the moon. Okay? And then it's written, you are here. And calls me and say, okay, look at the moon. You damn hop. Look at the moon, and then you'll find where you are. And I can see that I am on the Île Saint-Louis and so on and so forth. This, of course, is not working as a general case unless I have knowledge of the fact that I am the person which is represented by the blue dot over there. So everybody else is looking at the moon at the same time, even people in Turkey, and they think they are on Île Saint-Louis. It's not good. So what is needed is either situation, so being there, the map being nailed to a certain place, have a certain connection to the place, or epistemic segregation. The fact that me and only me, I and only I can have access to the information which is provided to the map, which is what situation does in most cases. So situation limits perceptual access to the map to the people who are close enough for the map to be informative for them and be useful for them to navigate the environment. So, and this is a part which is after the maps and pictures, which I didn't cover so far. And to finish, the category which I've been exploring with John Kulwicki and John Zembekis was the category of Borghesian maps. Borghesian maps are maps which are superposed to the environment. One-to-one maps which are superposed to the environment. You have plenty of them. Borges and other people, Umberto Eco, and semioticists in general, say these are absurdities. These are maps which have no meaning because you cannot use them. It's false, basically. It's an empirical fact that it is false. There are so many of those maps. They're everywhere. You go out in Paris and you can see a lot of signs on the street with fluorescent spray telling you where the pipes are. Underneath, these are one-to-one maps of a territory, and they're totally superposed. And this is the fact that they're superposed makes them useful to people. And we generalize a bit out of that. Signage on a road can be considered as a map. It's a directive map of what to do and not what to do, and it is important that it is superposed. So just to make a connection to what Andy was saying this morning, some of those things that we're using are maps, and they are one-to-one maps, and we interpret them as that. And of course, the problem remains of, the usability of those maps in general. But so the yellow brick road, it's the yellow brick road in the Wizard of Oz is a Borghesian maps which is superposed and takes you to the desired land. So a big claim here, and I finish on that, is that although Borkesian maps are latecomers in the jungle of the map taxonomy, they probably are conceptually prior to any other type of map. So the Ur map, the map which is the conceptual core, at the core of our concept map, is a map which is superposed with the environment. And all other cases are abstractions out of that. So thank you very much.